The builders of a brand new city want to make their mark on the world by making no mark at all. The city is in the desert near the Persian Gulf, in the oil-producing state of Abu Dhabi. And if you believe the promotional video, the city will have no carbon footprint.
Imagine.
Abu Dhabi imagines an entire city that releases no greenhouse gas.
Imagine a place where the challenge of living in an extreme climate is overcome at no cost to the environment.
The place is called Masdar City. When it's built, and Abu Dhabi has the money to build it, it's supposed to have 50,000 inhabitants. NPR science correspondent Joe Palca went there for our series Climate Connections with National Geographic. And Joe, how did this project get started?
Well, the leaders of Abu Dhabi wanted to get into the alternative energy field, and they looked around the world to see where there was the Silicon Valley of alternative energy, and there wasn't one. So they said, okay, we'll build it here.
And I suppose they got plenty of silicon since it's in the middle of the desert, yep. But setting that aside for a moment, why would Abu Dhabi, which is part of the United Arab Emirates, which has something like 10% of the world's oil reserves, get into the subject of carbon footprints and alternative energy?
Yeah, I mean, it's the obvious question, Steve. And I was going to ask Sultan Al-Jaber, who's the CEO of Masdar Initiative, exactly that. As I say, I was going to ask him, but he beat me to it.
Why is Abu Dhabi doing this? The answer is very simple. Number one, because we can. Number two, because we should. And because we believe that there's a natural extension for our involvement in the energy markets.
A natural extension for Abu Dhabi's energy industry? Does he mean when the oil runs out, they want to be able to do something else?
Yeah, imagine thinking that far in advance. But that's what they say they're doing. But there is another reason, Steve.
Abu Dhabi wanted to show that it's aware of its carbon footprint today.
So that's Khaled Awad. He's this Lebanese-trained engineer. He's the guy who's in charge of building the city. He's the first one there in the morning and the last one to leave at the end of the day.
We thought this is an ideal opportunity, I mean, for an oil producer to try to become a leader in renewable energy and sustainability was something really fascinating.
Fascinating if you have the money to do it.
Yeah, and they do. I mean, as you said, this is an oil-producing nation. They're making a lot of money, and they've taken $4 billion in cash, and they're planning to raise another $18 billion. And Khaled says it's a very calculated decision to spend this much on this Masdar city.
I think this is exactly what we wanted to do, is to show people that, look, we're serious about this. We're going to put so much resources to do it right, and we want you to come and join us there, and then they will start doing it with us.
So every time we put $3.50 gas in our SUVs, a little slice of it may be going back to Abu Dhabi and building this sustainable city. And how much interest is it generating around the world?
Well, it is getting quite a bit of interest. One of the first people to get on board with this was the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. They get a lot of people say, we want to partner with you, but MIT was interested in this whole renewability thing. So they're helping Masdar make an institute that will do renewable energy. And they've also got a lot of attention from architects. Foster and Partners in England is one of the firms that's involved. They've designed the initial plans for Masdar. You know, I talked to this Nader Ardalan. He's an architect and a professor of architecture at Harvard. And he understands that that Abu Dhabi would like to do something about its carbon footprint. And he says Masdar City is a start.
This is really an experimental town. It's a little town. It has 50,000 people in Abu Dhabi, which is, growing to be past a million people. This is a drop in the bucket, but this is a very important, precious drop.
And Ardalan says he understands why an oil-rich country would want to do this kind of project.
The people in oil-producing world want to be considered in a different light. They want to not be viewed as Bedouins. They want to be viewed as people of conscience and of education.
Although I guess they have to now figure out what that looks like physically when you build a brand new city from scratch in the desert.
Right, right. And the interesting thing is that Ardalan says, you know, it's going to help Abu Dhabi, but it's also going to help people in the West.
Because many of us are being invited to design these buildings. And from these, whether they're successful and some mistakes will be made, we'll be able to learn a lot. And I think we can then transfer this back to America, which is sort of funny because normally the transfer has been American technology, Western technology going to the East.
That's one of many architects intrigued by a plan to build a brand new city in the desert in the Persian Gulf state of Abu Dhabi. And Joe Palca, I'd like to know, if you get in a taxi, if you say, take me to Masdar City right now, what do you see?
Well, the first thing, the taxi gets lost because there's nothing to see yet. That's what happened to us anyway. But when you do get there, it's just basically a sign and a couple of construction trailers. But even when you see the construction trailers, you know it's something different, because instead of just a bunch of trailers sitting next to a vacant lot, it's got this giant tent over it. Why a tent? Well, they can save about 10 degrees of cooling because it's cooler inside these construction trailers simply because of the tent.
The construction trailers are cooler because there's this shield over them, basically.
Exactly. The other thing that's kind of interesting, and the tent is a good example of this, is that they are taking old-fashioned approaches to solving these modern problems. So even though the city itself will be completely modern, it won't look that different, because when they went to build it, they realized that people in the Middle East had already figured out some of these ways to save energy. I talked with this guy, Peter Sharrett. He's an energy consultant with the British firm called WSP, and it's one of the firms responsible for doing the design work at Masdar.
The visible part of the city is really a reinterpretation of an Arab town. The streets are narrow, they reflect and diffuse direct sunlight, they create shaded areas, we create microclimates by using water, we create areas where people can walk in a very hot environment. The bits then that you don't see so much of, those are what we call the clever technologies, the energy systems, the distributions, the networks that make all of the city hang together.
So what Sharrett's saying is they're going to use traditional methods to make a livable city in a beastly hot environment, but they're going to use some really clever technologies too.
What sort of clever technologies?
Well, I'm going to talk more about that in tomorrow's story, but I'll tell you about one today. It's called the Personal Rapid Transit System. It's a kind of a public transport, but instead of buses with fixed routes and gas engines, these are pods, solar-powered pods. Have you seen the Jetsons?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so it's like the Jetsons. You get into one of these pods, you punch in your destination, and off you go.
How can that save energy, though, if people are going individually in different places?
Well, solar-powered, more efficient. You don't need to fill up a whole bus for getting three people across town. Makes more sense.
Or even have a gas-guzzling taxi cab, for that matter.
You got it.
NPR's Joe Palca will be listening for more tomorrow. Thanks.
I'll be here.
The efficient way to keep up on climate change is to listen to Morning Edition from NPR News. You can read our year-long series on the effects of climate change at npr.org/climateconnections.
I believe in mystery.
I believe in family.
I believe in being who I am.
I believe in the power of failure.
And I believe normal life is extraordinary.
This I believe.
Our This I Believe essay today is about a belief that was created in just a moment. The story comes from Sarah Miles in San Francisco. Miles is the founder of the food pantry at St. Gregory of Nyssa Episcopal Church and author of the book Take This Bread. Here's our series curator, independent producer Jay Allison.
The idea that Sarah Miles would end up running a church food pantry would have come as a surprise to her before she did it. Miles was raised an atheist and lived a purely secular life until her beliefs transformed suddenly. Here is Sarah Miles with her essay for This I Believe.
Until recently, I thought being a Christian was all about belief. I didn't know any Christians. But I considered them people who believed in the virgin birth, for example, the way I believed in photosynthesis or germs. But then, in an experience I still can't logically explain, I walked into a church and a stranger handed me a chunk of bread. Suddenly, I knew that it was made out of real flour and water and yeast, yet I also knew that God, named Jesus, was alive and in my mouth. That first communion knocked me upside down. Faith turned out not to be abstract at all, but material and physical. I'd thought Christianity meant angels and trinities and being good. Instead, I discovered a religion rooted in the most ordinary yet subversive practice, a dinner table where everyone is welcome, where the despised and outcasts are honored. I came to believe that God is revealed not only in bread and wine during church services, but whenever we share food with others, particularly strangers. I came to believe that the fruits of creation are for everyone, without exception, not something to be doled out to insiders or the deserving. So, over the objections of some of my fellow parishioners, I started a food pantry right in the church sanctuary, giving away literally tons of oranges and potatoes and Cheerios around the very same altar where I'd eaten the body of Christ. We gave food to anyone who showed up. I met thieves, child abusers, millionaires, day laborers, politicians, schizophrenics, gangsters, bishops, all blown into my life through the restless power of a call to feed people. At the pantry, serving over 500 strangers a week, I confronted the same issues that had kept me from religion in the first place. Like church, the food pantry asked me to leave certainty behind, tangled me up with people I didn't particularly want to know, and scared me with its demand for more faith than I was ready to give. Because my new vocation didn't turn out to be as simple as going to church on Sundays and declaring myself saved. I had to trudge in the rain through housing projects, sit on the curb wiping the runny nose of a psychotic man, take the firing pin out of a battered woman's magnum, and then stick the gun in a cookie tin in the trunk of my car. I had to struggle with my atheist family, my doubting friends, and the prejudices and traditions of my newfound church. But I learned that hunger can lead to more life, that by sharing real food, I'd find communion with the most unlikely people, that by eating a piece of bread, I'd experience myself as part of one body. This I believe, that by opening ourselves to strangers, we will taste God.
Sarah Miles, with her essay for This I Believe. Every week, the food pantry is set up at the altar of her church and serves as much as 9 tons of food to about 600 people from all over San Francisco. Everyone is invited. Our invitation to write for this series also goes out to all of you. At npr.org/thisibelieve, you can find out more. For This I Believe, I'm Jay Allison.
And this Sunday on Weekend Edition, you can hear a This I Believe essay from listener Holly Dunsworth of State College, Pennsylvania. She writes about the nature of her belief in evolution.
Support for This I Believe comes from Prudential Retirement.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
James Lee Woodard walked out last week of a Texas prison after 27 years behind bars. The state agrees that Mr. Woodard was wrongfully convicted in 1981. He was convicted of killing a girl that he'd been dating, and now he's part of a pattern. Woodard is the 17th man from Dallas alone, the 17th to be exonerated by DNA evidence, and nearly all those freed are African Americans. As NPR's Wade Goodwin reports, the district attorney's office is predicting that Woodard is not going to be the last inmate exonerated.
James Lee Woodard had been dating 21-year-old Beverly Ann Jones for 7 months before she was raped and murdered. It was Christmas time, 1980, and although the young woman had no idea, her time was running out.
She told me that she was going to spend the weekend with her mother and take her mother some Christmas present. She was sitting in the bathtub when I left.
Woodard would never see Jones again. A few days later, Woodard was with his mother when word began racing around the neighborhood that Beverly Ann Jones had been found murdered down by the Trinity River. Woodard says he was stunned. He got in his car and drove around by himself for a while before going back to his mother's house.
I was sitting on her couch. I wanted to see the news, and someone knocked on the door, and it was the police.
Woodard didn't think anything of it. He thought the cops wanted his input to help their investigation. He hopped in his car and went down to the station behind the officers. But once he arrived, he quickly discovered that he was becoming the police's prime suspect. The detective took Woodard aside.
He said, "We really don't have nothing to tie you into it. It's your people who are saying you did it."
Beverly Jones' stepfather told the police that on the night she was murdered, Woodard had come to his house looking for her. That identification, which the stepfather now concedes was incorrect, steered the police toward Woodard, and they slapped him into jail. But even at that point, Woodard was blinded by his innocence.
You know, I just wrote it off as, hey, you know, they're going to lock me up, I guess, until they really check it out.
He had no idea how wrong he was. He was about to lose the next 3 decades of his life to prison. And the fact was, Woodard had a pretty good reason not to worry. He had a solid, if somewhat embarrassing, alibi. Woodard was two-timing Jones, and the night she was murdered, Woodard was 30 miles away in Arlington spending the night with his other girlfriend. Not only that, but they were at the girl's aunt's house, and the aunt was there all night, too. These two women told police that Woodard couldn't have murdered Jones because he was with them. But Woodard was an attractive suspect to the police. He was an ex-con because he'd been convicted of theft when he was a teenager. Dallas District Attorney Craig Watkins says that back in the late 70s and 80s, good alibis didn't necessarily carry a lot of weight when those circumstances were present.
Let's just go back during that time. The political climate was being tough on crime. And the success of the DAs, it was considered to be very successful. If you had a very high conviction rate, you sent a lot of folks to prison.
Watkins is Texas's first African-American district attorney, and he says he saw plenty of prosecutorial abuse when he was on the other side as a defense attorney. Now that he's running the DA's office, he's completely changed the culture. Watkins has demanded more money to investigate questionable convictions. And because of all the publicity, Dallas's tight-fisted county commissioners have reluctantly complied. When Watkins' investigators reviewed Woodard's case, they found blatant evidence of prosecutorial misconduct. It turns out one witness had come forward and told police that he'd seen Beverly Ann Jones in the company of 3 other men the night she was raped and murdered. Not only that, but 2 of these men had been arrested and charged with raping other women since the Jones murder. And even though prosecutors are required by law to turn over exculpatory evidence to defense counsel, Watkins says the police department and the Dallas District Attorney's Office at the time maliciously kept the information from the jury.
It's ruining lives. Not only is it ruining the defendant's lives, but the victim. Because if you just put someone in jail because it's easy, the person that actually committed the crime is still out there and still committing crime. I believe that the affairs of the DAs have really added to the criminal problem we have in Texas.
James Lee Woodard is the 17th man to be released using DNA evidence just from Dallas. The reason Dallas has so many exonerations is because, unlike every other major city in Texas, Dallas kept its DNA evidence instead of throwing it out. Perhaps the most unsettling fact in all of this is that out of the 40 cases to have been reviewed so far, there have been 17 exonerations. That's an error rate of more than 40%. When asked how many more exonerations can be expected, the Dallas DA says a lot.
It's going to be more than dozens. It's going to be a lot more. I couldn't tell you an exact number. I think there's a large number of individuals that may have been convicted where there's no DNA, and then the real perpetrators out there, and we have to figure out how to address that.
What's new about this case is that James Lee Woodard is the first to be exonerated of murder. All the other men were convicted of rape. The district attorney very likely could have kept Woodard in prison by simply taking the position that even though the DNA proved Woodard hadn't been the one to rape Jones, that meant nothing to his murder conviction. But the Dallas district attorney says he has no interest in keeping innocent men in prison, and he's investigating other questionable cases in cooperation with the Innocence Project of Texas. Jeff Blackburn is the chief counsel.
The easy cases are over. Mr. Woodard's case is an example of what's really out there now. For every James Lee Woodard there is out there, there are 500 other guys exactly like him who just didn't have the good luck to be from a county where they preserved evidence. That doesn't make them any less innocent. It just makes the work to get them out and to prove their innocence that much harder.
Blackburn has enlisted the help of students and professors from 3 Texas law schools and 2 universities to help with the labor-intensive process of combing through the case files. He says he has 4 more, almost exactly like James Lee Woodard's, already in line. Blackburn believes the number of innocent men in Texas prisons convicted of rape and murder runs into the hundreds. But for one innocent man, life begins anew after 27 years of waiting.
Like an adventure. I mean, it's so many different things to see. And I like people. And I like seeing different things and new things.
James Lee Woodard doesn't know how a cell phone works, has no inkling of Macintosh versus PC. Improbably, he's neither bitter nor angry. And if you ask, he will not agree that those years in prison were for naught.
Time is what you make of it. You're living no matter where you are. I think I came out pretty good. I think I won. I think I'm a winner.
As the years went by, Woodard never gave up writing letters and writs to anybody who might help him prove his innocence. He couldn't get parole because he steadfastly refused to say he was sorry, even after one board member quietly took him aside and said they'd set him free if he would. He loves dogs and would still like to have a family, but believes most women are likely to see him as damaged goods. But with an easy smile, fit and attractive at age 55, he could be wrong about that. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
You can get a look at letters that James Lee Woodard sent as he tried to gain his release by going to NPR.org. Next, we're going to report on a city that's feeling the pangs of a more subtle change. In this case, it's the pangs of hunger. The city is Los Angeles, where people spend much time in their cars, so it's fitting that some of the most popular meals are served on wheels. Taco trucks are a favorite spot for good, inexpensive Mexican food. But next week, L.A. County is enacting tougher laws that truck owners in parts of L.A. say could put them out of business. NPR's Ben Bergman investigates.
L.A.'s most famous restaurant critic gets paid to eat wherever he wants. Yet several times a week, Jonathan Gold pulls over to the side of the road and eats cuisine served on a paper plate out of a truck.
I've probably been to 3,000 or 4,000 taco trucks in my life. It's a hobby, you might say.
Gold, the only food critic to have won a Pulitzer Prize, says most of the time the tacos are so delicious that even if he intends to take them home to his family, he can't help but devour the tacos in the time it takes to walk from the truck to his car.
If I had to eat only one taco for the rest of my life, it would probably be a perfect taco al pastor with marinated pork cooked on a revolving spit, the crispy bubbly bits carved off to order, put in the thing with hot salsa, and a little tiny sliver of roasted pineapple.
But not everyone is so enamored of taco trucks, known to their critics as roach coaches. L.A. County recently passed new laws that will make it a misdemeanor to park a taco truck in the same place for more than an hour, punishable with a $1,000 fine or 6 months in jail. The county already has similar rules on the books, but they only carry a $60 fine and are rarely enforced. The harsher laws are in response to complaints from business owners like Maria Melgar, who says taco trucks have made her life miserable.
Oh, a lot of problem. Mucho problema.
Melgar owns the Birria Guadalajara in East L.A. She serves only one kind of meat, slow-cooked goat. At a recent lunch hour, the dimly lit restaurant was nearly empty, save for a man sitting at the center table, and he was there for an interview.
My name is Luis Herrera. I'm the president of the Greater East Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce.
Herrera, who represents 70 restaurants, says taco trucks, or catering trucks as he prefers to call them, deliberately park in front of successful restaurants and steal away customers.
After 6 o'clock, this restaurant is closed because that's the hour that the catering trucks come in. They can't compete with the prices of the catering trucks. Their prices are so much less because their overhead is zero.
Herrera suspects many taco trucks don't pay taxes and don't pay attention to health and safety.
That's not competition. That's not being fair.
Herrera has been in this area, East L.A., for nearly 40 years, selling used cars across the street. The population here is 98% Hispanic, and the streets are home to hundreds of taco trucks. No neighborhood is more affected by the new rules than East L.A. At Tacos El Galuzu, down the street from Birria Guadalajara, customers are lined up to buy 90-cent tacos al pastor or asada quesadillas for $3.25. Juan Torres, originally from Mexico, has owned this truck for 7 years and works here every night of the week. He's still paying off his truck, which costs $70,000. Should the health department come by, as it does every couple months, he keeps the truck immaculately clean.
I have everything permits. I pay taxes, been the license.
Despite the fact they're mobile, most taco trucks, including this one, park on the same street every night. Torres even pays hundreds of dollars in rent to the business he parks in front of. He says the new laws could ruin his business because he depends on repeat customers who always know where to find him.
And the people coming don't see me. he can go another place, another restaurant, you know.
Torres and other truck owners have hired an attorney, Philip Greenwald, to challenge the rules.
The potential of a jail sentence and or a $1,000 fine for parking to sell food? That's a bit overkill. It's outrageous.
While Greenwald pursues a legal strategy, truck owners are forming a taco resistance. When the rules go into effect May 15th, over 100 taco truck owners vow to stay parked right where they are. Ben Bergman, NPR News, Los Angeles.
We heard today of the passing of a woman who became known as the matriarch of legal interracial marriage. 41 years ago, the Supreme Court's landmark Loving decision struck down all laws designed to prevent marriage across races. The Loving case was not named for the bond between married couples. It was named for Mildred and Richard Loving, a black woman and a white man who fought for the right to live as husband and wife in their home state of Virginia. Mildred Loving died on Friday at the age of 68. Those who knew Mildred Loving said she would have eschewed that matriarch title. She was shy and quiet and avoided publicity, even as her legal battle made its way to the Supreme Court. Bernard Cohen is one of two lawyers who argued the Loving case before the Supreme Court.
They were very simple people who were not interested in winning any civil rights principle. They just were in love with one another and wanted the right to live together as husband and wife in Virginia without interference from officialdom.
Mildred Jeter and Richard Loving grew up on the same country road in rural Caroline County, Virginia. In 1958, they were married in Washington, D.C. A few years later, they returned to Virginia, where they were arrested, jailed, and banished from the state for violating Virginia's Racial Integrity Act. Again, Bernard Cohen.
They woke up in the middle of the night to see the sheriff and five deputies standing around their bed, shining flashlights into their faces. And Richard Loving ran to the dresser where their marriage certificate existed and said, "Look, we're married." And the sheriff said, "Not in this state, you're not."
Mrs. Loving spent the past three decades living as a widow. Her husband Richard died in a car accident in 1975. Though it is in no way an official holiday, the June 12th anniversary of the Loving decision is celebrated by many people who are in interracial marriages or are the product of interracial marriages. Ken Tanabe is the founder of the Loving Day Project, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program, Mr. Tanabe.
Thanks for having me.
What's the legacy of the Loving decision? How do we see that in everyday life?
First of all, it's worth mentioning that the Loving decision ended about 400 years of history of laws. That being said, the legacy today is really, it's like Brown versus Board of Education, in the sense that we should learn about it, it should be taught, and people should keep it in mind when they're considering the situation for interracial couples and their children today.
So how do you celebrate on June 12th?
Well, that's the beauty of it. It's really quite flexible. Loving Day, the idea is that people can celebrate in any way that they see fit. In New York, we host a huge barbecue outdoors for usually about 1,000 people. But people can celebrate with their friends and family, a backyard barbecue, a picnic in the park, a dinner party, anything they like, really, as long as it's around June 12th and everyone who's invited knows the purpose of the occasion.
Why do you promote Loving Day celebration now that interracial marriage is much more common? Is it more accepted now?
I believe it is, but I also believe that prejudice is very much still in existence. I think it's important to use the holiday as a way to sort of acknowledge that racism still exists and that we have some problems to work through still.
How do you view Mildred and Richard Loving, Mildred in particular?
Honestly, to me, they're sort of heroes. I'm the product of an interracial marriage myself, and I wonder how my life would have gone, or even if I would have been here at all, if they hadn't, argued this case and eventually gotten that right for all of us. But I know that themselves are very modest people. They weren't out to crusade. They really just were looking to live together and live the way they wanted to.
Sure. Ken, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Ken Tanabe is the founder of the Loving Day Project. Mildred Loving passed away on Friday. She was 68 years old.
We're going to talk next about a private detective who was completely a product of his time, but whose story has endured into our time. The detective is Philip Marlowe. He's the creation of the novelist Raymond Chandler. And in the minds of many readers, he might still be wandering the streets of Depression-era Los Angeles, solving crimes and letting off wisecracks like this. "I needed a drink. I needed a lot of life insurance. I needed a vacation. What I had was a coat, a hat, and a gun. Philip Marlowe made it through tough times, and after 9/11, a modern novelist wrote that we needed to be inspired by that same character again. So now we've performed our own investigation. NPR's Mike Schuster has the latest installment of In Character, our series exploring famous American fictional characters.
Raymond Chandler began to develop the Marlowe character in short stories and novellas he published in pulp fiction magazines like Black Mask and Dime Detective. Marlowe emerged as a fully realized character in novel form with the publication of The Big Sleep in 1939. Marlowe was cool, smart, world-weary, even droll. He dressed in dark gray suits, lived in lonely rooms, worked in empty offices. He seemed a perfect fit for Humphrey Bogart, who starred in the 1946 film version of The Big Sleep with Lauren Bacall.
You know, I don't see what there is to be cagey about, Mr. Marlowe, and I don't like your manners.
Well, I'm not crazy about yours. I didn't ask to see you. I don't mind if you don't like my manners. I don't like them myself. They're pretty bad. I grieve over them long winter evenings, and I don't mind your ritzing me or drinking your lunch out of a bottle. But don't waste your time trying to cross-examine me.
People don't talk to me like that.
Oh.
The world Marlowe lived in was mean, filled with dangerous men and fickle women. Marlowe was tough, sure, but not cold. Otto Penzler, editor of the Black Lizard Big Book of Pulps, places Marlowe in the tradition of the American Western, transposed to the modern urban landscape.
Chandler saw him and wrote about it famously as a knight, a man of purity, a man of honor, a man of integrity. That was not necessarily true for most of the private eyes who would do whatever it took to get the job done.
Chandler wrote his Marlowe stories almost always in the first person. So Marlowe was the narrator as well as the main character, and he took on something of the literary flavor of Chandler's fine writing. Van Heflin played him in this 1947 radio version of the novella Red Wind.
There was a rough desert wind blowing into Los Angeles that evening. It was one of those hot, dry Santa Anas that come down through the mountain passes and curl your hair, make your nerves jump and your skin itch. On nights like that, every booze party ends up in a fight, and meek little housewives feel the edge of a carving knife and study their husbands' necks. Anything can happen when the Santa Ana blows in from the desert.
The character was so vivid, for some, Marlowe seemed true to life, but Chandler himself challenged that in a 1958 radio interview for the BBC with Ian Fleming.
He doesn't exist in real life.
No, he doesn't.
Unless you can make him seem real.
Yes. Marlowe seems real to me. I mean, I visualize him quite clearly.
Oh, I know, but that's because I've known him so long. That
yeah.
He's not real as a specimen of a private detective.
Yeah.
Fleming and Chandler discussed Marlowe's emotions, which Fleming observed are far more nuanced and complex than his own creation, James Bond.
On the other hand, Philip Marlowe feels them and speaks about them. He may
speak
about
he's always confused.
He is.
He's like me.
Marlowe makes his way alone and isolated through a highly chaotic world. That's the way Robert Crace sees him. Crace is a writer of contemporary crime fiction. He has written the highly successful novels featuring Private Eye Elvis Cole.
Though Marlowe might feign it from time to time, I never believed Philip Marlowe was a cold, detached man. He was always personally involved on some level. He always felt the pain of the characters he was dealing with.
You alone, Joe?
Yeah, except for this.
My. Such a lot of guns around town. It's a few brains. You know, you're the second guy I've met today that seems to think a gat in the hand means the world with a tail. Put it down, Joe.
Marlowe was tough enough to be regarded as hard-boiled.
Again, Otto Penzler.
But I don't think he wanted to be. He would rather have used his brains in a more sensitive way than a lot of other private eyes would have done.
Dick Powell was the first to play Marlowe in a 1944 version of Farewell, My Lovely. The title was changed to Murder, My Sweet. The character comes through even though the tough guy language is a bit quaint today.
I've been out peeking under old Sunday sections for a barber named Dominic whose wife wanted him back. And I never found him. I just found out all over again how big this city is. My feet hurt, and my mind felt like a plumber's handkerchief. The office bottle hadn't sparked me up, so I'd taken out my little black book and decided to go grouse hunting. Nothing like soft shoulders to improve my morale.
Later, many actors played Marlowe, including James Garner, Elliot Gould, James Caan, and even Danny Glover, and Robert Mitchum in a remake of The Big Sleep in 1978.
It was close to 11 when I got back to my apartment. I'd concealed a murder and suppressed evidence for 24 hours, but I was still at large and nobody seemed unduly worried. As I got to the door, I heard my television was on. I wasn't in, so I guess somebody else must be.
Screenwriters have always felt free to adapt Chandler's work to different times and places. There was no television when Chandler wrote The Big Sleep, and this version took place in London, not Chandler's favorite city, L.A. A lot of people think Mitchum was the perfect Marlowe. Among his fans is Robert Crace, who first encountered Marlowe when he was 15 and found The Little Sister in a secondhand bookshop.
I read it that night, literally in one sitting, and it threw open the doors and kicked out the walls for detective fiction, for Private Eyes, for Los Angeles. I mean, all the great loves of my life stem from that book.
Crace's characters, Elvis Cole and his buddy Joe Pike, both take something from Marlowe, but they are their own men. Crace, who has another Elvis Cole novel, Chasing Darkness, coming out this summer, strives for what Chandler achieved, a character that keeps connecting with readers for years and years.
Marlowe was resonant with the public and is resonant even today and to all of us who followed in Chandler's footsteps. At his base, Marlowe is us. There's nothing super heroic about him. He's a regular guy who has somehow found a way to divine order out of the chaos of our lives.
Marlowe lives on. Last year, a pilot was made for a TV series, and there's talk of another movie with Clive Owen playing the Private Eye. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
Just found this quote from the novelist Daniel Handler after 9/11, saying he was inspired by Raymond Chandler's example, by Philip Marlowe's example, that real trouble cannot be erased, only endured. And that is more soothing to me than any cheerful grin. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.